One, two, three, four.
How is economic inequality undermining our democratic systems? In what ways is social media reshaping political landscapes and democracy? Can we design political institutions that adapt to rapid social and technological changes while remaining stable? How is journalism critical for the health of our democracies?
Arash Abizadeh is the R.B. Angus Professor of Political Science at McGill University. His research has focused on democratic theory, including topics such as immigration and border control. Abizadeh also specializes in 17th and 18th century philosophy and has recently published the book Hobbes and the Two Faces of Ethics. He is currently working on a book about social and political power and is the associate editor of Free and Equal, a journal of ethics and public affairs.
Arash Abizadeh, welcome to The Creative Process.
Thank you very much for having me.
So just tell us a little bit first about your upbringing, your educational journey, and what drew you to study political philosophy. How do you feel your upbringing influenced the way you view the world?
Well, I had a kind of a tumultuous upbringing as a kid. My parents moved around quite a bit. I was a child in North America for many years, and my parents are originally from Iran, and we went to Iran for 5 years. We were there during the revolution, so I saw a lot of political activity and a lot of tumult as a young child. And then we came back to Canada, where I grew up. And so the experience of escaping a dangerous political situation is definitely something that has marked me as a child and that drew me to thinking about issues of social justice and political stability and what kind of regime is best, political society, and so on. So I'm sure that that has played a big role in my interest in political philosophy. Though I have to say that as a young person, as an adolescent, a teenager, and then later in my 20s, I was curious to learn just about a lot of different things. And so when I was in high school, I was very interested in science. I almost was going to go into genetics. That was something that interested me a lot. And so in undergraduate, I couldn't really make up my mind between social science and philosophy. And so I actually did social science, but I always found myself drawn to the more fundamental, foundational philosophical questions. So I ended up doing political theory or political philosophy later on, partly inspired by a wonderful undergraduate professor I had, but also because I found that it was a way to straddle my interests. As a political theorist or a political philosopher, we think very hard both about empirical questions in social science, but also about the foundational philosophical questions. So that's something that really drew me to this field.
Yes, and these issues could not be more important at all stages in history. But I mean, when we look at the state of democracy today, that some people take our political systems just for granted, they almost don't see it because they haven't had that inside-outside experience that you had. But, you know, democracy today is very different, as you know, than 10, 15 or 20 years ago. We talk about Trump and the rise of populism, or, you know, he seems to occupy this rent-free space in millions of people's heads every day for over a decade. Wherever we are in the world, we seem to be like orientating ourselves around, whether it's him or other populist figures. And I feel this would not have been possible without the rise of social media, where anonymity exacerbates divisions and discord. So our reaction to these different opinions goes beyond mere disagreement, blurring the line between opinions and facts. Do you feel that the root of such intense responses lies somewhere within our evolutionary history? You talked about having an early interest in genetics and things. If so, how can we navigate our primal reactions to respond with understanding and kindness instead of these gut immediate reactions that we see so often today?
Yeah, I think that human beings have shown a tremendous amount of diversity, both historically and across cultures and between individuals, about how they behave in different circumstances. And so the question is, why is it that sometimes people react with fear and aggression, and sometimes they react with tremendous amount of kindness and altruism and generosity? We are capable of all of these different kinds of reactions. So I'm more interested in social structures and the way that social structures channel our actions, the way that they shape our beliefs, and they shape our dispositions to behave and react and respond to different circumstances. So I think you're absolutely right to point to the rise of social media. This is a new phenomenon, and just the internet in general, it's a new phenomenon that we are grappling with and that we don't completely understand. And the thing to note is that the political regimes that we are living under in the liberal democratic West, for example, these are regimes whose constitutional orders were thought of and invented and imagined a few hundred years ago. And so we're kind of stuck with these designs that didn't necessarily imagine the circumstances that we're living in now. And so a real challenge for us is how, if we want to live in stable democracies that respect people's freedoms and that respect each person's dignity and treats us as equals with equal dignity before the law, before the political community, and so on, how is it that we can do that in the face of these new technologies where, as you say, sometimes negative aspects of our dynamic in social interaction can get exacerbated? And so it's a real question, how do we reproduce the kinds of democratic spaces for deliberation, for exchange, for constructive collective action in cyberspace? Is it possible? And if it is possible, how do we do it? And so a lot of people have paid a lot of attention to, for example, the structure of the algorithms that are being implemented by the corporations that run these supposedly public spaces for us, but they're privately controlled and they wield a tremendous amount of power over us. You know, these corporations collect a tremendous amount of data about us, and they know a lot about us in order to be able to advertise to us and make money from their media. But are they using them in ways that enhance the possibility for positive, creative, democratic deliberation and exchange? Probably we haven't gotten there yet. And so it's a real question, how do we do that?
Yeah, I mean, I just came out of recently a conversation with directors of the Stanford D School, where many of these things were made and are being made, right? And this director, and she's involved in design, says, oh, she thinks that AI is influencing her thoughts. You were talking there about that social listening, which Meta and other companies are doing to advertise to us, but that it has very obvious political impacts as well. We've seen them influencing elections. It's not a paranoid thought at all to think that, yeah, these technologies are influencing, or, you know, as those involved in designing of it have said to me, they think that their thoughts are kind of being controlled and nudged.
Well, of course, they're being nudged because, for example, we know that some of the algorithms that, for example, Facebook was using highlight or tend to make prominent posts that engage people the most. And in that medium, what can engage people the most is often your sense of outrage, often a sense of fear or anger. And so if the goal is to keep people on the platform as long as possible, then you have to appeal to aspects of the human personality that are not necessarily the aspects that you want to appeal to if what you're looking for is a healthy, deliberative public sphere. So there's a tension between what democracy needs in order to sustain our democratic institutions over the long run and sustain our liberties over the long run, and what it is that a for-profit commercial corporation needs to do in order to maximize people's time on social media in order to increase their profits.
Yes, completely. And we see what seems very much like a new great game for dominance of AI globally and making investments. And, you know, social listening is just the tip of the iceberg. I think there's many other elements that we don't really see. And of course, we've seen the rise of the far right in Europe and the use of the great replacement theory to generate fear and curb immigration. What are your views on this issue? I know you've written a lot about immigration and migration. And what are some of the ways we could deal with this thorny issue in a more humane and responsible way?
I mean, this has a very long history, but one of the sad things that we're seeing today is that I think we live in a world where many people have been left behind in their own countries, even if their own country is doing well. So if you take a country like the United States, for example, which is a wealthy country, globally speaking, but there's a tremendous amount of inequality, social and economic inequality. And there's a lot of people who may have been doing well, their family may have been doing well in previous decades, but who were left behind and did not benefit from the kind of globalization regime that we saw in the previous few decades. And so people want answers. They want to know, well, why is it that, for example, the next generation is no longer able to buy a house? Why is it that we can't find a job with a decent wage that enables us to put food on the table and so on? So why is it that the towns that we live in are being evacuated and left dilapidated and so on in desperate condition? So this is happening in various countries across the world, including in the countries that are well-to-do. And so the question for people is, well, what's the source? These are highly complex issues and people want answers. And often it's the job of political leaders to lead by showing the way forward to people. And unfortunately, I think what has happened with some of these populist movements is that the target of the problems which often are social inequality within the country itself. They're looking for scapegoats, and there's nobody easier to make a scapegoat than the people who don't have a vote in your political community. Precisely because their votes don't count, the politicians can target them. And so that's what's been happening with these populist movements. They've been targeting migrants as if they were the source of the problem. And they're a very visible issue. Of course, all kinds of migration creates challenges for every political society. But these are challenges that in strong and healthy liberal democratic societies, we're able to manage very well. And actually, the migration turns out to be a tremendous benefit to these countries. But because these populist leaders are looking for a scapegoat, and because there is a visible and very powerless scapegoat that they can find, they've been targeting them and whipping up sentiment, often in racist terms, to give people a false but easy answer to why they have difficulties in the economy, in the society, when I think that often the root problems of the difficulties and challenges that people are facing lie in the tremendous amount of economic inequality. So you have some people who are extremely rich. They're able to influence politics in a very powerful way that the rest of us who don't have that kind of wealth are incapable of doing. And so, you know, there's no surprise that politicians are making decisions that benefit the 1%. It's still the case. But unfortunately, the target has turned to migrants.
You wrote Hobbes and the Two Faces of Ethics. And if we explore Hobbes' philosophy, how might we adapt his thoughts to contemporary debates around democratic governance, these things you're talking about, federalism, minority rights, and the role of majoritarianism in political stability? You know, what do you think his responses would likely be?
Well, I have a lot of different and varied intellectual interests. So actually, my interest in Hobbes is not directly related to my interest in contemporary democratic politics. It's more of a historical interest that I have about the history of philosophy. But there is a link, and I can get to it, but it's a little bit of a roundabout link. So Hobbes was a figure in the 17th century who lived in a tumultuous period of English history during the Civil Wars, where there was a lot of bloodshed and obviously disorder. And so one of his primary concerns was, how is it that a political society can remain stable? How do we prevent political societies from descending into civil war? His answer was a very influential answer. It was that what you need is a very strong state, a state with a supreme authority that is capable of giving an unchallenged answer to disputes and to be able to enforce its decisions. So Hobbes was an absolutist. So he's not necessarily a thinker that is very friendly to, for example, theorists who want to ensure that the government or the state does not go beyond certain bounds in how it treats its subjects or citizens. So I think the insight that we can get from Hobbes is that no matter how much we progress in our political institutions, in the entrenchment of democracy, in the entrenchments of individual rights, in the entrenchment of social rights, however well we are doing, we can't let down our guard, because political and social institutions ultimately are human constructions that are fragile, and they require a lot of care and attention. And if people just simply don't care and don't pay attention to the nature of our political institutions, then you might just end up finding yourself in political circumstances that you don't want to be in. There is a kind of belief amongst people who have lived in political societies that have been stable for, let's say, a few decades or even 100 years, to think that, yes, well, those kinds of things would never happen here. But 100 years is a short time span in history. And just because there's been 100 years of stability doesn't mean that that's necessarily going to continue. It takes a lot of work. And we could all end up being in the position of the migrants that are being vilified by many groups in currently stable societies.
Yes, but what are some of those ways that we can, you're talking about making our institutions more stable, but also adaptable, because we have to be fluid. There's so much changing so rapidly. So what are some of those concrete ways, as much as it's possible, to reimagine, restructure our institutions?
Well, one of the things that I've come to believe, and this is through a reading of the history of political theory and also contemporary social science, is that there is a tremendous tension between healthy democracy and deep economic inequalities. I don't think that in the long run, democracies can survive in a healthy way unless we address the problem of economic inequalities. So if we have individuals who are sort of living day to day on the one hand, and we have other individuals who are billionaires in our societies on the other hand, it will be very difficult for us to have a genuine democracy. Because firstly, behind the scenes, there will be a lot of manipulation of the political process by those who have economic power. But also because when there's a tremendous amount of inequality, it's very hard for people to have equal standing and status in the social realm and to be treated as equals. And economic inequality leads to political instability. It leads to unrest, resentment, and so on. So this is something that really has to, I think, be addressed. It can't just be a question of fixing political institutions. It also has to be thinking about the nature of our economic structure.
Indeed. And also, we can't always have infinite growth if we're not addressing some of those inequalities.
I completely agree. So as a first question, I wanted to return briefly to this idea of our political societies as being human constructions. And in your article, I believe it's called Hobbes' Conventionalist Theology, you argue that for Hobbes, both God and the state are artificial persons. So I was wondering, does this imply that like God, the state requires some level of faith? Or maybe put differently, is equally vulnerable to the possibility of disbelief?
Yes. Well, there's a lot of things about the nature of society that only exist because we believe that they exist, or only have the properties or the qualities that they have because we take them to have these properties. This is what is sometimes in philosophy and the social sciences called social construction. For example, take money, right? The fact that the bills, whether they're paper or plastic now, I guess, you know, the bills in your pocket have a certain exchange value. Let's say it's a $100 bill or 50 euros or whatever it is that you have in your pocket. It only has that value because in a human community, people recognize it as having that value. In other words, it only has it because we believe that it has it. And then it really does have that value. It is a $100 bill. It is a 50 euro note. These are social constructions. Or take the example of a prime minister of a country. It's not a natural property. You can't look at their, you know, body and read it off the nature of their cells that, oh yes, this one is the prime minister. The fact that someone is a prime minister is a social fact that is only true because people believe that it's true. And so their belief is what makes it to be true. All of the political order that we have is constructed in this way on the basis of people believing things and treating others as if these things were true. And by treating them as if it were true, we thereby make it true. The same as, you know, for example, two people being married to each other. They're only married because we recognize them as being married. In fact, the whole idea of being married is something that we've constructed. And so without us believing in it, it wouldn't exist. We wouldn't have these kinds of social institutions like money, like the state. And so, yes, our beliefs and the way that we treat each other are partly what make our social reality to be true. And so if we fundamentally change the things that we believe, if we fundamentally change the way that we treat each other, then we would have a very different social organization. The state is constructed. It's not a natural phenomenon.
Right. So I guess in light of events like the January 6th insurrection, where we had people in the United States challenging the legitimacy of an elected president, what do you make of the fact that the public seems to be losing faith or disbelieving democratic procedures like voting?
Yes. So, you know, states can remain stable on the basis of various kinds of pillars. One of those pillars is repression. So, you know, for example, in highly repressive states, let's take a country like Iran, where a tremendous proportion of the populace is very oppressed and is not content with the regime. In a state like that, what holds it together? In large part because people fear being killed and imprisoned and tortured. So that's repression. That's one way that the state props itself up. In other countries, there is that too. But another pillar for the stability of the state is a kind of sociological legitimacy. It's the sense that people believe and they adhere to the rules as laid down by the state. They think that, oh yes, because these are our political institutions, we believe that they're legitimate. And so we're going to follow these laws. Not because necessarily I am worried about being punished if I don't follow it, but because I'm just disposed to do so because these are my political institutions and I have an allegiance to them. And so when we see events where people are calling into question the legitimacy of their own political institutions, that will, depending on the numbers, depending on how widespread that is a challenge to the stability of the state. Yes, absolutely. And so for democracies, the challenge is particularly sharp because in a democracy, not only do you need legitimacy in general as a pillar of propping up the state, but democracy itself depends on people's participation in political processes in order for it to work. If people are not willing to participate in voting, in respecting the outcome of the vote, in upholding fair elections, if people are not willing to do these things, then that political regime will collapse and will be replaced by something else. And we've seen this in many countries where if there are powerful social forces that are not willing to abide by the outcomes of elections, to manipulate the elections in such a way that everybody realizes this is not the outcome, what's left is repression. Democracy has presented itself as an alternative to determining the winner in virtue of who has the most guns. Democracy says, look, we're going to give you a chance to quote unquote fight it out, but not in a violent fashion, but rather through electoral campaigning, attempting to persuade fellow citizens, coalition building, and so on. That all presupposes that everybody is willing to say, look, if we've lost this time around, our allegiance to the institutions themselves are greater than our desire to be the ones who rule in the upcoming years. If that is lost, democracy is in quite a bit of trouble if people lose that commitment. If they fail to see that the alternatives are civil war, violence, and repression. And that's one of the wonderful things about democracy is that it gives people an opportunity to try to resolve social conflict in a nonviolent, peaceful fashion. Because the costs of violent conflict resolution are very great to all the parties involved. I mean, we can see this in the countries that have descended into civil war. Probably they would have all done better if they had had a commitment to institutions to resolve these things nonviolently, where everybody had a chance and they may have taken turns. This is often what happens in democracies, right? One side wins this time, another side wins the next time, and so on. This prospect of potentially taking turns is what makes people in a democracy realize, well, if we lost this time, it's not worth risking civil war, even though our goals are very important. We have a chance of realizing those goals the next time.
Indeed. And you just spoke about our rights as citizens, our rights to democracy, not just as voters, but as engaged citizens. And so I understand that for misinformation or disinformation to work, it's not just about making us believe the fake news. It's in making us feel so distrustful of the whole process that we don't engage as citizens. And we allow those who want to seize power because everything seems kind of corrupt.
Well, this is what I was saying about the tension between a properly functioning democracy and tremendous economic inequality. When there's tremendous economic inequality, it's actually very difficult for democratic institutions to be responsive to the needs of the most powerless people in the society. Because the way that you're going to win elections, if it's being determined by how much money do you have in your coffers, then the most economically well off are the ones who are going to be able to call the shots. That is going to lead to people losing faith in the political process because their needs are not going to be addressed. And so that's what I was trying to get at earlier about democracy. It's a kind of regime that requires people to see why it's worthwhile supporting these political institutions, participating in them, and that there's a payoff to participating in them. If people can't see the payoff, they're not going to participate and it will just go into a worse and worse spiral. So that's the problem with a tremendous amount of inequality in a democratic society. Another problem, as you were pointing out, is public policy questions, political questions are extremely complex and requires a tremendous amount of time and energy and resources to try and just even understand whether a particular law is to one's benefit or not. People don't have that kind of time to spend to analyze all these things. So what we need as citizens is heuristics. We need leaders who are capable of showing us in a simplified fashion what the fundamental issues are. And that gives a tremendous amount of power to political leaders to be able to set the agenda for democratic deliberation. And so what we need is a political system that incentivizes the kinds of political leaders who are willing to address the real issues over the long run that will benefit people, rather than politicians who are in the pocket of the wealthiest people in the society.
Exactly. And that they talk over us. And you're an advocate for sortition, which is something that I don't hear spoken about a lot. Just explain what that is. And it's really about engaging different sectors of society to be directly involved in the political process and not just voting during these regular voting cycles.
Right. So what sortition is, if we go back to the word democracy, this is something that we've gotten from the ancient Greeks. Athens was a primary example of this. And so for them, democracy was the regime that involved a lot of use of lotteries, or sortition, which is the use of lotteries for selecting political officers. And the idea here is that not everybody can be a politician, and that elections have a certain kind of role to play that I've been talking about at length, but also that sortition has also another function, which is that it treats everybody as equals. Everybody from all walks of life, it doesn't matter what social class, what gender, what race, a lottery doesn't care about any of those. It's just random. You select. And so if you select a particular legislative body using lottery or sortition, chances are that it's going to look different than a chamber that was elected, where, as we know, often elected chambers, it's heavily populated by people who went to law school. So there's a particular profile, and much less, for example, someone who's a manual laborer. But a lottery would see to it that a legislative body would actually reflect the nature and composition of the society at large, from rich to poor, whatever your background is, whatever position you occupy, and so on. So that's a kind of tremendous expression of political equality. And of course, one of the worries that people might have about this is say, well, what about expertise? Political questions are complex. So how could the average citizen partake in decision-making processes? Well, the answer is that average citizens can partake in decision-making processes if they spend the time and effort. And usually it's not worth the time and effort. You know, we have lives, we have children, we have people that we care for, we have lots of things going on in our lives. But if you are a part of a dedicated legislature and you are taking the time, and the reason why you take the time is you know that you're part of the decision-making body, right? Then average citizens are perfectly capable of participating and making decisions in a group. We know this because we've seen this happen under structured conditions of good deliberation. Of course, if you select people by random, there's going to be some people who have mental health problems. There's going to be some people who are criminals. But you know what? That's true under every regime that we've known. We have racists who are elected to office. We've had sexists who are judges. We've had dictators who are psychopaths. We've had all kinds of political leaders. So this is not a knock against the use of lotteries. This is just a feature of human beings. So yeah, we can't get away from that. But the thought is that if you have selection by lottery, there'd be decision-making bodies that through a process of deliberation can make good and wise decisions. That's in part how Athens did things.
So tying into generally, I guess, political participation, people tend nowadays to criticize modern day politics on the basis that it feels a lot of the time like a spectacle or a bad play. And yet there's this element in Hobbes that you emphasize in the conventions article again, that political representation is itself a kind of performative act that we must all as an audience buy into. So to what extent is this theatrical aspect of politics kind of inevitable? And is it a problem that we know it to be an act or that we feel it to be an act?
Well, this is the thing, is I think the difference is between believing something that you know not to be true and living under an illusion, right? So I might think that this rock has demonic powers in front of me. It's not true. It's just a regular rock. And I might treat it as if it has these demonic powers over me. And so I might behave in various ways. I might, for example, worship the rock. I might pray to the rock. I might be afraid of the rock. All of these things can happen. But I'm under false beliefs. I'm under an illusion. None of this is true, even though my false beliefs are affecting how I act. But in the case of what I was talking about earlier of social construction, and that's going to apply to these representatives that you're talking about, these are not false beliefs. These are beliefs that make themselves true. In the sense, just like the money, it's not false that your $20 bill is worth $20. It's true. but it's only true because we believe that it's true, right? So that's the nature of this representation. It's not that we necessarily have to be under illusions about the nature of politics. We can perfectly recognize that our political representatives are our representatives, thanks to the fact that we recognize them to be that and we give them that power and so on. But it doesn't require illusions. And so the project of trying to diminish illusions, the project of trying to snuff out misinformation and fake news is perfectly compatible with democratic politics. In fact, it's crucial to democratic politics. It's not going to undermine the legitimacy of our political representatives insofar as their legitimacy is not dependent on false beliefs. If you see the distinction that I'm trying to draw between false beliefs and beliefs that are just a matter of helping to construct social reality as it really is, as in the case of money.
As a master's student at LSE, I wrote my dissertation on the relationship between belief and political legitimacy. Abizadeh's work on Hobbes and his broader discussion of social constructs raised some questions for me about this relationship, which I'd like to explore a bit in this interlude. As Abizadeh notes, political legitimacy, meaning the justification that underpins a state's authority to govern, is a true fact, but only as a result of the social reality we have constructed through our beliefs. Once we are aware of this, the question then becomes, are we capable of believing in something that we know exists as a consequence of belief? I think the implications of this sort of question are in some ways troubling, and in others, really exciting. This is because if affirming democratic legitimacy is always to some degree dependent on belief, we need not be constrained by the pressure to produce perfect institutions and procedures. Instead, how we design them can remain an open question. For instance, we might see elections as a sort of ritual or theatrical performance, or we might employ aesthetic devices like symbols to depict the representative relationship between the state and the democratic will of we the people. As Kant observed, symbols are representative vehicles that generate a perceptible formal relation between abstract concepts and concrete signs. So, by introducing aesthetics into our political context, we can reshape democratic representation into a symbolic form. Viewed as a sign for the people's collective will, our democracies become representative and legitimate in an abstract sense, despite their current flaws. So, once we recognize that belief is necessary, we need not be constrained by the pressure to produce perfectly legitimate democracies. Instead, as long as we are working towards this goal, voting procedures and our other institutions can be flexibly reinterpreted, ritualized, and aestheticized in whatever ways best capture and reinforce our beliefs. Importantly, though, as Abizadeh reminds us, even these reimagined institutions are only as powerful as the individuals who engage with them. This brings us to the symbolic significance of casting a ballot. Like Abizadeh suggests, our ballots are not just tools used to legitimize electoral outcomes. They are expressions of belief in democracy's abstract ideals. Standing at the altar of the polling station, we proclaim, "I believe in democracy, in the possibility of representation, and in the power vested in we the people." Each and every vote is an invocation of this creed, even in our darkest moments of doubt and uncertainty. And now, back to the interview.
We've been discussing how we can be more engaged. We haven't discussed your new journal. I want to get into that. But also, what is the role of journalists? So many publications are suffering now and trying to, you know, form a new economic model. And the reality is just very difficult for journalists to publish, national, local newspapers to survive. What are your reflections on the future of journalism?
Right. So I think it's a great question. And I think it's a crucial question for democracy. We know that corruption rises in politics when there's less local news. So the decimation of local news that has been occurring over the past few decades is a tremendous blow to the health of our political institutions. And so you're absolutely right that our democracy is at stake when we're talking about the nature of journalism. Unfortunately, I don't know what the answers are. I don't have any expertise. I'm not an expert about the news media and how it should be structured, how it is structured, and so on. What I do know is that the current state requires attention, but I don't know what the answers are. So great question. I hope that you have somebody as a guest in the future who can answer it, and I can listen to the podcast and hear what the good answers are.
Yes, it's a difficult question to ask and answer. In your own realm, you and your co-editors decided to resign en masse from philosophy and public affairs, calling the academic publishing industry a lucrative scam, which I had not heard this light shined on it before. And you'd criticize the way it is doing considerable damage to our intellectual and scientific culture. Could you expand on that and what ultimately led you to form your new journal, Free and Equal?
Well, one of the things that is a huge, tremendous surprise to people who are not in academia is when you describe to them the nature of academic journal publishing, particularly with for-profit commercial publishers. So typically when people write things, for example, for newspapers or magazines, you get paid for writing it by the publisher. The publisher pays for it, and then they publish and make money off of their magazine or their newspaper, and then they'll have subscribers who want to read it. The academic journal publishing model is extremely strange because academics do not charge the publishers for their written work. Instead, academics are paid by universities to do the research that they do and for the time they spend on writing these articles. So ultimately, the public is paying for the production of academic research, and then these commercial publishers get it for free. And then what happens? It turns out that the readers are the same people, the same community of people who've been writing them, namely the professors and academics who are working at these research institutions, universities. They also then have to turn back and pay to read their own works because many of these journals are behind paywalls. Many people in the public will have seen this. If you try and read an article from these academic journals, often you can't access them unless you pay $50 per article. It's a tremendous amount of money that you would have to pay. And so the university libraries have been paying huge sums to these corporations in order to access the research that university professors are producing. And so if you think about it, they get something for free that they turn around and sell back to the very people who funded the production of it in the first place. So in a way, universities are paying twice. It's a crazy situation because this is involving the use of public funds, and they are making tremendous profits by doing this. Now, something that has recently happened because of this, governments and funding agencies have been pressing for open access. So the idea here is make the articles free to the public. Everybody should have access. And so these for-profit corporations, they've seen the writing on the wall and they've jumped on the bandwagon, but they've made a little tweak. They've actually hijacked the whole thing. Because what they've done now is they say, okay, we're going to make it open access. But authors, not only are we not going to pay you when you submit your articles, but for the privilege of us publishing your article and to make it open access, you're going to have to pay us thousands of dollars per article. Now, who's paying those thousands of dollars per article? Once again, it's the publicly funded granting agencies at universities. So you can see the double payment is kind of occurring again just through the back door. It's true that it's open access. And so it's actually rapidly changed the journal publishing landscape because now these for-profit journals are making more money per article that they publish. And so what they're doing is they're turning around and putting a tremendous amount of pressure on editors to publish more and more articles, regardless of quality constraints. And so you have a proliferation of junk science, in fact, junk journals that are just publishing, AI generated material, things that make no sense, just because they're going to make money off of every article published open access. This is placing a tremendous amount of pressure on many editors who are trying to maintain the integrity of their journals. And what happened with us in particular at Philosophy and Public Affairs, which was one of the premier journals in political philosophy, is that we came to the conclusion collectively that our future and fulfilling our purposes as researchers, as scholars, as academics committed to the integrity of high quality research, that these were at odds with the kinds of incentives that these commercial publishers have. And so we decided to resign en masse and to set up an alternative, what is called a diamond open access journal. Diamond means that you don't charge readers, so it's open access, but you also don't charge authors. It requires funding, but actually it turns out the libraries are very happy to fund diamond open access models. Because once you cut out the intermediary, it turns out that it's a lot cheaper for university libraries to just directly fund these journals because now they don't have to pay these huge subscription fees or author processing fees. They don't have to pay them to these for-profit journals anymore. All that they're paying for is the service that is being provided by the journal, which is hosting the material, editing it, publishing it, copy editing it, all that sort of thing. But that costs a lot less than what it is that the for-profit journals are charging because they're making a profit.
Exactly. Pay the intellectual laborers and the middleman. It's funny because we were just talking there about the future of journalism, and I'm not sure that a lot of newspapers or news agencies are aware of this, because I came across it first when I read your article in The Guardian. It's quite shocking. Just broader reflections, you were saying how in order to keep a thriving democracy, it's something that we have to commit to. We also see in many universities, the field of humanities, it's not something that is as funded. People are maybe turning away from the humanities. They're not seeing, or they're told that there's not a kind of economic benefit. They're not seeing how it fits into their life. You know, what are your reflections on the future of the humanities and how we bring it across that it is something that is important for all of our lives, for those who feel kind of a little bit shut out from it or are not fully committed to understanding what role it plays and whether it's supporting or helping us maintain a thriving democracy or just helping us live more reflective lives?
I don't think I can speak to the humanities in general, but I can speak to philosophy in particular. So in the case of philosophy, and the reason why I'm putting it this way is because I think the answer to your question depends on the particular fields and the answers are going to look different. But in the case of philosophy, I think the answer is rather straightforward, which is that philosophical investigation is a discipline that trains people to think analytically and clearly and rigorously. And in a way, it's the kind of thinking that is required in all domains of the sciences, in all domains of the social sciences, and in many aspects of life to be able to think critically. So I know, for example, philosophy graduates, some of them go on and they go into business, right? They're hired by corporations. Because why? Because they know that these are people who can think critically, analyze a problem, take it apart, and look to see how it is that they can find solutions to the problem. So this is about training the mind in order to think rigorously. And then in the academy itself, there's a lot of different fields of philosophy that are central to the investigations in other fields, including scientific fields. So one of the branches of philosophy, for example, is ethics, right? Everybody cares about the ethics of artificial intelligence now. Everybody cares about ethics in the realm of medicine and public health. These are all questions that philosophers are trained to grapple with in the most rigorous fashion, and they're not disconnected from all of the other fields that people may be interested to pursue. I mean, a lot of the thinking that has gone into the development of these large language models comes out of not just computer science and not just mathematics and so on, but also about philosophical reflections on the nature of language, linguistics, but also philosophy of language and so on. So to think that we can have a research university, to think that we can advance scientifically without also at the same time investing into these different branches of human knowledge. And the example that I'm talking about here is philosophy. It's just a fundamental mistake. The nature of the development of human knowledge. These, you know, in the 17th century, to take the example of Hobbes when he was living, people were not so specialized. If you were a, you know, John Locke, who I suspect many of your listeners will be familiar with. John Locke, yes, was a political philosopher. He also wrote about philosophy of language, but he was also a medical doctor, such as they were in the 17th century, right? He attempted to heal people and things. I mean, the same thing with Hobbes, right? He not only dealt with political philosophy and ethics, but also mathematics and physics and so on. They were all interested in all these branches of human knowledge. That's no longer possible because our knowledge has advanced so much that in order to just master one field, we have to specialize a lot. But what has not changed is the fact that these different branches of human knowledge, they depend on the advancement of the others as well. So we can't delude ourselves into thinking, oh, well, all we're going to do is we're going to invest in the STEM or the hard sciences without also thinking about these other branches of human knowledge. I think that's just a diluted way of thinking about the nature of research institutions and the way that research goes forward.
Yeah, it certainly feels like the quote unquote Renaissance man category is becoming pretty obsolete nowadays, at least to some extent. I just wanted to go back to your work on voting procedures and the ways that privileging the majority sometimes means disenfranchising minority voter preferences. I was wondering, are there cases in which a group of preferences that find themselves in the persistent minority grouping actually end up reflecting a potentially extremist or dangerous set of views, like, for instance, those held by militant far-right groups in the United States? And does political equality entitle these groups to the same kind of increased agential power as other minority preference groups?
Right. That's a great question. So just to sort of clarify what my initial thought is, that look, if you have a political society where there is a persistent minority over time, remember, democracy is supposed to empower everybody and give them power and agency in participating in political process and the capacity to be able to see that they are capable of making a contribution to political outcomes. If you're a persistent minority and you would always lose out in political outcomes, then it looks like democracy has a problem under those circumstances. And of course, this matters a lot to me as a Canadian, because historically we're a political society with persistent minorities. One persistent minority that's obvious, I think, to everyone is the French-Canadian persistent minority. So that on cultural linguistic matters, if we just had a majoritarian democracy at the federal level, if we didn't have federalism, for example, that would probably mean that the Francophones would always lose out on certain kinds of cultural linguistic questions. So they wouldn't be treated as equals, is how I would put it. So that's the background. I do think that we have to pay some attention to how is it that we can empower minorities. However, you're right to say that sometimes there can be minorities with various kinds of views and preferences that can be dangerous to others. South African apartheid is one good example of this, where you had a white minority who was ruling over everybody else and had a, you know, kind of racist ideology behind the nature of their rule. So what do you do when minorities have dangerous views? That's a very difficult question, but it's a question whose answer is not particular to minorities, because we can ask the same question about majorities. What do you do if majorities have, you know, racist views about their minority? Now we can switch from South African apartheid to the United States under the regime of slavery. What do you do about that, right? So these are difficult questions for democracy, which is to say, what happens when people in a democracy have views and attitudes that are counter-democratic? They don't recognize the equality of their fellow citizens. They don't respect the freedom of their fellow citizens, and so on. So what do you do if you live in a society where men believe that women do not have a right to participate, right? What do you do about that? But this is not something that is specific to the issue of minorities, if you see what I mean. So you were asking a very good question, but I don't think that it's a question that a theory about minority rights has to grapple with in particular. Any democratic theory has to grapple with in general. So the attempt to empower persistent minorities doesn't face a new problem, doesn't have its own difficulty here. This is a more general difficulty.
Also, when we talk about minorities, we're the minorities on this planet, but we're the dominating species, right? So in general, you know, what are your reflections on the kind of world we're leaving future generations, and how we can live more equitably, how we can just restore our balance with the lives of future generations going forward? What are some of the ways you might clear your mind as you get inspired by being in nature and reflect on the beauty and wonder of the natural world?
I think that there's a kind of tension in the question that you're asking, because on the one hand, you're asking for me to reflect on the future that we're leaving for future generations. We're on a fairly bad trajectory, the way that we're going forward, which, you know, we're contaminating our planet and rapidly changing its climate in a way that will probably wreak a lot of havoc in the years to come, and that will create a lot of suffering, both for human beings and for non-human creatures that live in our planet. So that's a kind of pessimistic thought. I think that human beings are very adaptable and very ingenious and industrious in the ways that we're able to adapt. So I would like to hope, I'd like to think that we will have ways of trying to grapple with the crises that we're bringing upon ourselves in the future, and that there are ways forward. But my worry is that ingeniousness and industriousness will be available only to the well-off and not to the destitute and poor on our planet. And so really, again, for me, this is a social and political question. How is it that we can ensure that the wealth and technologies that we're using to adapt to a rapidly changing climate will be used in a way that is equitable across various societies on this planet? The tension in your question is because at the same time, you know, you're inviting me to think about the aspects of nature and our planet that give me calm. And so thinking about the future doesn't necessarily calm me down. It riles me up. But I have to say that, you know, as a Canadian, going out into nature is part of a regular practice that brings a tremendous amount of joy and pleasure. So just the fact that we're able still, thankfully, at this point, in this country, at least, we're able to go and go canoeing on rapids and rivers over the summer. It's a wonderful experience when the forest fires aren't clogging up our lungs. The beauty of nature is definitely something that we should all cherish.
Yes, I think in many ways, whether we have religious beliefs or not, we are in some ways living in a miracle. I feel we have to respect the balance and our small place on this planet. We think we're the only ones. But maybe in closing, as you think about the future and education and what you'd like young people to know, preserve and remember, I might share some reflections or perhaps a Persian expression that might be something that you hold in your mind as your reflections on the world and what you've learned.
I guess what I would say is that for young people, often in trying to decide the path that you're taking into the future, that there's a lot of different pressures. There's a lot of different expectations, whether it be from our peers, from our parents, from extended family. Often it's quite difficult to stay true to your own sense of what drives you. And I think that it's a really important practice to listen to the inner voice that we all have about what really drives us. In deciding, for example, the choice of your career is a really important decision that you make. And it's important to try to follow a path that is true to the kind of person that you are. These are all kind of general platitudes and banalities, but they're worth, I think, remembering at times of difficult decision making. Other than that, I don't think that I have any particular wisdom to impart on anybody. I mean, you know, we all muddle along and we make our mistakes and then we learn from them and we carry on and we go forward. So I guess if I can leave you with a last few words, it's just, you know, keep muddling along and don't give up.
That's an important message. So thank you, Arash Abizadeh, for sharing your insights on political philosophy and the nature of democracy and how we can each become more engaged citizens. And thank you for your reflections on the balance between authority and equality and your vision for open access in academia. It just reminds us about the importance of free inquiry and how we can collectively create a better tomorrow. Thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
Thank you very much for having me, and good luck to you with this really interesting project that you got going.
The Creative Process podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk and Virginia Moschetti with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producers on this episode were Sophie Garnier and Virginia Moschetti. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Katie Foster. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anatolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you enjoy listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just drop us a line at team@creativeprocess.info. Thanks for listening.